News Talk 580 KMJ presents Hometown Heroes, honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom.
Hometown Heroes is brought to you by Humana. Humana is proud to honor our hometown heroes.
Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes with you every Saturday here on KMJ. Whether you catch us on the AM side of your dial at 580, maybe on FM 105.9 or online around the world at kmjnow.com. Hopefully you've heard the show before and you know what we do here. We talk to World War II veterans about their experiences during the war. We don't think those stories should be forgotten. We want to preserve them. We want to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice and be inspired and educated along the way. And, you know, with this show, it's only one veteran a week, typically, that we're able to save a story. And part of the purpose of this show is to encourage you at home. Maybe you have a grandfather, an uncle, a dad, a mom who served in uniform during World War II or any other time in the military. Go talk to them. See if you can get some of those stories out of them and save them for your family's purposes. And along those lines, I like to bring attention to other efforts to do those kinds of things in our community. There are a lot of great organizations that are doing great things to honor our veterans. And one of the neat ones in recent years has come into being at Fresno State. It's the Central California War Veterans Oral History Project. Each semester, they have a great reception at the sparkling new Madden Library. I've been privileged to be at a few of those and hear some of the stories. And it's so neat to see the different veterans get up, know that they have an audience of fellow veterans, and share some of those stories. And what's most special about it is seeing the interaction between our greatest generation and what some might call our latest generation, today's college students, to see the respect that the younger people have for their elders, to see how much they learn through it. It truly is an educational experience at Fresno State. And enough from me talking about it. We're going to hear from some people who have experienced it on both ends of that process, telling the stories and listening to them. Let's talk to a Fresno State student first. Will Chapman, you're a senior at Fresno State?
That is correct.
What are you majoring in?
I'm a history major.
History major. So I guess when you heard about the Veterans Oral History Project, it was kind of right up your alley?
Oh, definitely, yes.
This is not the first semester you've done this. And can you get credit for the class more than once?
Yes, you can get credit for it twice. But I do them as independent study because it's not a history thing per se on campus. So
you took the class, which is put on by Dr. Gary Rice in the Mass Communication and Journalism program, and you liked it so much you just kept doing the histories whether you were getting credit for your degree necessarily or not.
Right. I saw the flyer the first semester that they were doing it, and I signed up, and I truly loved it, and I've become somewhat passionate about it.
So you've interviewed six different veterans now?
Yes.
Are you still in touch with all six of those veterans?
Unfortunately not. There's one that I've lost track of, and that's a little bit frightening. But otherwise, yes, I try and...
Well, I was wondering if they were all still alive, because my experience in doing this show is I make some good friends. I just don't keep them for very long. That's the nature of the beast. What's the biggest thing that you've gotten out of this from hearing these veterans' stories and gaining an understanding of what life was like when they served?
Well, in particular for the World War II veterans, I think the greatest thing to be gained from it is that, like my veteran here, Mr. Wolf, said that there's sometimes your generation faces a lot of challenges, and it's up to you to meet them.
Yeah, I think we have some generations coming up that might find themselves in those same boats. And you mentioned in particular the World War II veterans. One of the neat things about this project is that it encompasses all eras. So You'll go to this reception after the semester when all the students have put their things together, and you've got World War II veterans, Korean War veterans, Cold War, Vietnam, even today's conflicts from Iraq and Afghanistan. Did you ever expect to get so much out of listening to some old people talk?
Well, I'm a bit of a bore myself. I like old things, being
Me
a
too.
History major. But it's enormously rewarding to hear firsthand what it was like and what they themselves had to go through for just being at the age that I am. It's incredible.
And I guess you are probably a good case study here because you are a history major, so you're studying history already.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know, and most of those history classes, you don't have someone who lived it who can tell you about it. You're reading it in a book. How big a difference has it made for you to talk to people who were there?
It is an enormous difference. It's what keeps my personal faith alive in history is being able to have a tangible research experience with somebody and listen to them firsthand and try and preserve their history. That's extremely important to me.
Well, I'm going to have some more questions for you in a little bit. But first, why don't you tell us about the veteran who came along with you here today?
Very well. His name is Mr. Robert Wolf. He was born in Detroit, worked early on as an auto worker in part of Detroit's great auto industry. And then through a abnormally long struggle to try and find a way to let his country allow him to serve it, he eventually found his way into the Naval Armed Guard and served as a radio operator aboard three different merchant ships in the war effort. I hope I'm doing you justice there.
Well, we'll get the story from him in a moment. What is it that struck you the most about listening to him remember those days?
How vivid it can be at times. Personally, that's the greatest takeaway, is that these sorts of experiences aren't floating around in your memory, that there a lot of them are very lucid and stick with you for a long time.
I'm glad you said that. It's a pet peeve of mine when I have people come up and tell me, oh, oral histories, you're relying on that. Well, they're telling you something they saw in a movie or read in a book. I say, why don't you go live it first and then come back and tell me about that. So let's talk to a guy who did live it, Mr. Bob Wolf, 87 years old. You just heard Will talk about him, and now I'm going to talk to him. All right, so Will mentioned there that it was not exactly easy for you to get into the service. Well, let me go back before you became a member of our armed forces. What do you remember about December 7th, 1941? How'd you find out about what happened out in Hawaii?
I was a soda jerk for a while, and I was I worked as a hat and coat checker at a Graceland ballroom where they had this was the age of the big bands.
Right.
Such as Glenn Miller, Artie Shaw, Benny Goodman, and I could have been working there.
And I'm curious if you told one of those college students that you were a soda jerk, if they'd have any idea what you were talking about. We don't have those soda fountains very many places anymore.
That's right.
But so here you are, a coat checker, and getting a taste of some of these big bands. Pearl Harbor comes along. Did you have an idea that your life might change because of what happened out there?
Well, I was still in high school.
Mm-hmm.
I graduated when I was 17, just past 17.
Right.
My two older brothers and a couple cousins and my friends were already in.
So you were feeling left out.
Well, my parents, my mother and father wouldn't sign me off, sign off on me, wouldn't allow me. I wanted to go in the Navy because I had an uncle who was in the Navy during World War I. And he said, if you want to see part of the world, your best chance would be to go in the Navy. That kind of struck a chord with me. And so I wanted to go in the Navy. My parents wouldn't sign off on me. So I had another uncle, Walter, who worked at the Ford Motor Company. They were currently building Army tanks. So through him, I applied at Ford and went into a typing pool.
All right.
Because at the beginning of the war, there were very few women in the factories.
Right.
And allowed in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I was in the typing pool for a couple of days when someone came and got me and took me to the superintendent's office of the whole plant. This was the Mercury plant.
All right.
Of the Ford Motor Company. And as luck would have it, after an interview, I was hired to work in the superintendent's office. And there was a gentleman there who used to be a reporter for the Detroit Times. He became my consultant. He and I got along very well. So at some point in time, I had to decide which branch of the service I wanted to go into or be drafted. So Charles Richardson, his name was, he knew the Navy chief who was the head of one of the induction centers. So he called him and made an appointment, and I went down and took a physical. My preference would have been to go in the Navy Air Corps.
All right. You wanted to fly.
Right.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, I didn't have enough teeth in my mouth.
How'd that happen?
Well, in the good old days, during what we used to call the Great Depression, some people claim we're in the same kind of depression now as we were back then, we children did not get to go to dentists. And cooking was different than it is today. I don't think I was unique. A lot of people lost teeth.
Yeah, that was reality, sure.
Eating hard candy and different things, I suppose. So anyway, I passed the physical except for my teeth, so I was not allowed to go in the Air Force, a Navy Air Force.
Right.
So I then went in the regular Navy through Great Lakes, near Chicago.
Right.
And while I was in Great Lakes, I had another test. The Navy determined that I didn't even have enough teeth to stay in the Navy. So they said I would have to have partial plates made at my own expense.
Mm.
Travel to Milwaukee at a dentist there. And so in the meantime, they assigned me to a naval dentist at Great Lakes. So I guess he liked me because he offered me a job there.
Mm.
And he said I could go to Northwestern University and study on the job. Well, that was not for me. You know, I had brothers and friends and everybody. I said, no, I couldn't do that.
And you said no because you really wanted to get in there and do something, it sounds like. That was your motivation?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I had my brothers in. I had my friends were in.
Because some guys might have said, oh, I get to go to Northwestern and hang out here while the war's over there? Great. And you were saying, no, thanks.
I said it. As a matter of fact, I said it three times.
Mm-hmm.
I said it back at the Ford Motor Company because Charlie was going to give me a deferment and said I could go to college from there. I said it again about the teeth. You know, I didn't.
Right.
I could have gone back and gone to college, I guess, there. So, and then the dentist.
So what was it that made you so determined to get in there? Was it just peer pressure, just the fact that you had brothers and friends over there, or was it something more?
It could have been, you know, that's not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country.
Mm-hmm.
Or some.
Well, and you clearly backed that up with those decisions that you made. So how did it work out from there once you told that dentist, no, I want to go?
Well, I was still there at the Great Lakes. They also tested me for hearing. I'm assuming it's much like your eye test, if I could distinguish the length of sounds. You know, is this shorter, longer,
right,
broader, whatever. Apparently I passed that, so I was shipped off to radioman school at a college in Ohio, which lasted 6 months. I wound up in the top 10% of the class, so I became a radioman third class. And then from there, I was shipped out to Los Angeles, California for 6 weeks additional training for the Armed Guard. In other words, merchant ships are different than Navy ships.
Right.
At the most, they would have three operators on a ship.
Mm-hmm.
So that means one person had to maintain the equipment, had to get all messages or send all messages. And so we stood four on and eight off around the clock, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm.
And that was on the first ship.
It's really interesting. You know, I've obviously interviewed a lot of Navy guys and also a few guys that ended up in the Merchant Marines. And there seemed to be at the time some stigma or that the Navy people looked down at the Merchant Marines for some reason. It seems to me that you, working for the Navy as an armed guard on these merchant ships, were in just as much danger, if not more so, because of the determination the Japanese had to sink merchant ships, the fact that you guys weren't as well defended as the Navy ships would have been. How did you feel about how safe of a job you had?
Well, as I say, as an 18-year-old, 19-year-old, life is sweet. I mean,
even when you were on a tanker, which basically if it gets torpedoed is blowing you from here to smithereens.
The tanker was commandeered. It was a German-built tanker with a Scandinavian crew.
Mm-hmm.
It was commandeered in the Panama Canal when we went to war.
Uh-huh.
And we were challenged by our own Navy.
Because it's a German ship.
Well, it's German-built, so it didn't look quite like our ships, I guess.
So they weren't necessarily believing you guys were okay to let through.
We had to convince them.
Was that your job as a radio operator, to talk to him?
Well, the second school I went to was also semi-four.
Uh-huh.
We had to be signalmen and radioman.
Uh-huh.
Except when I went on the troop ships, then we had more help. We had signalmen.
Gotcha.
But the first ship I was on, we had to do both.
Well, I know there's plenty of stories we can get to, and we're going to try to fit in a few in this hour today. We're also going to hear from another student and another veteran. We're talking about the program at Fresno State, the Central California War Veterans Oral History Project. And it's something that if you are a Fresno State student, I hope you'll consider. It's something that if you are a veteran of any conflict, I hope you will think about participating in and sharing some of your experience and your wisdom with these students. We'll talk more about it when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. After a down-to-the-wire Bulldog game, there's nothing quite like throwing yourself onto a comfortable bed. Paul Leffler here. You know, I heard my buddy Ray Ocanto talking about his mattress on the radio, and I thought, wait just a second. Wait till I tell you about the one my wife and I found at Sleep Retreat. Sleep Retreat is Fresno's only premium bedding store on El Paso, right next to Fashion Furniture. I heard Ray use the word comfort, but I can't imagine any bed being more comfortable than the Tempur-Pedic Cloud Lux we're sleeping on. It's soft where you want it to be soft, firm where you want it to be firm, and if you really want the long and short of it, it doesn't matter if your legs are long or short. My wife Tanya's about 5'1 and petite. I'm 6'3 and not so petite. But that oh-so-comfortable Tempur-Pedic mattress fits us both like a glove. I guess I should have seen it coming. After all, Tempur-Pedic invented memory foam. Tempur-Pedic is the most recommended sleep surface in America. And nobody in Central California knows Tempur-Pedic better than the fine folks at Sleep Retreat on El Paso next to Fashion Furniture.
Hey, this is Paul Leffler, and if you've been listening to KMJ for any length of time, you've probably heard me wax poetic about my hometown of Los Banos at one point or another. Every city has its secrets, and I'm going to fill you in on one my old neighbors have been keeping for 40 years. No matter where you live in the valley, you probably go through Los Banos every once in a while, so next time you're cruising down the 152, pull into Ming's Restaurant. The owner, Paul Cito, has been showing off his skills in the kitchen there since 1968. He has perfected the best Mongolian beef this side of the Great Wall. Delicate rice noodles underneath tender slices of beef with a flavor I can't even put into words. Whether you prefer mild, medium, or spicy, you'll be coming back for more. Ming's is closed on Mondays, so don't say I didn't warn you. But stop in any other day and try the pork wonton soup, Chinese chicken salad, or get everyone's attention with the sizzling chicken and vegetables. The possibilities are endless, but they all have one thing in common. Ming's time-tested commitment to taking your taste buds on a thrill ride. Ming's Restaurant, 435 West Pacheco Boulevard in Los Banos.
On the front line of freedom, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler on News Talk 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We're going to continue now with Bob Wolf, World War II veteran of the U.S. Navy, serving on merchant ships during World War II. We talked to him about it a little bit, and there are a few more things I want to cover while we have time. For one, you wouldn't have met your wife if you hadn't have been in the Navy in World War II. We'll get to that. And you wouldn't have had the thrill, some might not call it a thrill, of surviving a typhoon aboard ship. What was that like? When and where did that happen?
Someplace between the United States and Australia. I'm not quite sure. And I want to mention here that we were never allowed to write or keep track of anything.
Mm. You know, in case it fell into the wrong hands.
A loose lip can sink a ship.
Amen. I bet you saw that on a poster or two during that time period. So, yeah, so it's hard to remember exactly where you were. And if you were in it, it would probably be hard to tell where in the world you were when that typhoon was going on. What did it feel like? How did you experience that aboard ship?
It was on an empty tanker. The tanker happened to be empty at the time, which means that, you know, there was more action.
Yeah.
But they had cables or ropes that you could hang on to getting to the chow hall. But the chow hall was empty for about 3 or 4 days.
I imagine so. You wouldn't hold down anything if you tried to eat it.
Didn't bother me, but it was empty for quite a while.
Now, you said, you know, being an 18 and 19-year-old operating the radios on these ships, even knowing that there might be a threat out there, that you weren't too scared. What about the typhoon? Did that get your attention a little bit? Were you at all concerned that you might not survive it?
I don't think so.
No.
To me, the whole thing was an adventure.
Uh-huh.
And you were with friends.
You mentioned that one of the reasons you wanted to get into the service was your two older brothers already being in. Did they both make it home from the war?
Yes. One was a Marine. He was wounded.
Mm-hmm.
But he said he got shot in the rear.
It's not always the one you're most proud of, but it's probably the best place to get shot in actuality. So for you, I know we don't have time to get all your stories, and if people want to read and hear the rest of your stories, they can check out the archive at the Fresno State Madden Library, where all the veterans' interviews compiled by this Central California War Veterans Oral History Project will be kept for perpetuity. Tell me how it is that you came to meet your wife of 66 years now.
Well, I made a friend of a sailor named Tom Donnan. He was one of the gunners aboard the tanker.
Mm-hmm.
We went out drinking one night or one day. He mentioned to me that I would be perfect to become his brother-in-law, to marry his sister.
And he didn't like his sister very much, did he? I'm just teasing. So he said you'd be perfect to be his brother-in-law.
Yes.
Did you have your doubts?
I'd be perfect for his sister called Muriel, M-U-R-I-E-L. So anyway, I was dropped off from the tanker in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't enjoy New York too long. I requested a transfer back to the West Coast. Back then, all trains had to go through Chicago.
Uh-huh.
I had time, coming from Detroit to Chicago, I had time to wait for the train. So I called Tom's mother and talked to her, and she got Muriel home from her work. And so Muriel and I walked around, and she said, this is where Tom was a soda jerk, and this is where Tom went to school and so on. And then Muriel and I had a good afternoon and decided to write to each other. And we wrote for well over a year. And then I got leave and spent some time with Muriel again. And we decided to get engaged. And then we got married about a year later.
You got married after the war was over, and that means you had some more to survive aboard these merchant ships. You mentioned the tanker. That was one of the kind of ships you were aboard. You also, at the end of the war, were on a victory ship, bringing troops home from Europe. What was that like?
That was wonderful.
I imagine they were pretty glad to be aboard.
I was happy to see France and Italy, troops up there, and bring them home. We went into Boston, and then on the last voyage, I don't have a piece of paper to prove it, but I believe that I think I'm the one that got the message that we were originally scheduled to go back through the canal and be part of the invasion force for Japan.
So you're carrying a ship full of troops.
Correct.
Headed for the Panama Canal and to the Pacific for this invasion, but you get a message on the radio that says?
We got diverted to Virginia.
Uh-huh. I bet those guys on board were pretty happy to see Virginia.
They were quite happy, yes.
Can you paint a picture of that for us, what it was like aboard ship when you guys got there?
Wild.
When you look back on it now, and obviously the lens of time is added to your perspective a little bit when you know the bigger picture of what was going on in World War II. How fortunate do you think you were to have had the experience you had and to have made it through the war?
I feel very fortunate. And I also feel fortunate when I remember that my father came over from Germany and met my mother.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, I was born in the United States. You know, the greatest nation in the world, mm-hmm. as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. And you and your family clearly were a big part of that in World War II. You have a secret to share with us for staying married for 66 years? I think we had a lot of people in our audience who would like to know that.
Well, when somebody asked me, I say that's probably the most important thing as a young person you can do is find the right partner.
Mm-hmm.
And I did.
I guess you did. Is there anything that I didn't ask you about that you think people ought to know about men of your generation, Americans of your generation, and what you did during World War II?
Yes, I'd like to say to future generations that you're living in the greatest country in the world, and change it if you can, but pass it on. Don't destroy it.
What was it when you got a phone call and they said, hey, we want you to tell your military story over here at Fresno State? What was it that made you say yes?
Well, I've been working on it since 2003 because I have grandchildren.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother did that for us. She wrote something
mm-hmm.
for us. And I also have something about my father. So I have a history.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, well, at least I can do is pass that on.
And you are passing this on to your family. I'm also curious, the experience of working with Will here and seeing how attentively he listened to all these details and the questions that he was interested in finding answers to. What did you get out of that interaction with a guy who you can probably look at and say, hey, I was kind of like that almost 70 years ago?
I'm grateful for him. Mm-hmm. He helped me a lot because I had the data, but I didn't quite know how to put it together.
And two more questions for you. One, if there's a veteran out there listening to this and he's been asked by someone to share his story and he's been hesitant, what would you say to him after your experience of working with students at Fresno State in this project? What would you say to someone who's a little unsure of whether or not they should talk about those things that happened so long ago?
Well, I guess I would say every veteran's story is probably unique.
Mm-hmm.
And why not share it?
Amen. The other question I had, just trying to put some puzzle pieces together here, and I remember you talking about when you tried to go in, you wanted to be a naval aviator, and that didn't work out. And all the options that you had that you passed on because you were so determined to get in, and it turns out you end up being a radio man, and you're exposed to this equipment that a lot of teenagers probably hadn't gotten to play with, and you end up as a computer programmer and working on computer systems involved in the defense industry in America. Can you look back and see the seeds of that career interest being planted in your time in the Navy, or am I making a connection that doesn't exist?
No, I think it does exist. For example, for some reason, I decided in high school to take typing. I don't know why. I took cooking too, but I mean, I went to summer school to get rid of heavy subjects.
Uh-huh.
My senior year, and took two heavy subjects. So then in my senior year, I had cooking and typing and something else. So I took typing. Well, look, that's probably the best thing I got out of high school.
Mm-hmm.
Because all the way through life, I've used that.
Sure. I was just putting those pieces together. It seems like either you had a pretty good plan for your life or somebody else did.
Well, the other thing, I thought I wanted to be an electrical engineer, but I was unacceptable to the college I wanted to get into, two of them. So I wound up at the University of Chicago, who has a different diversity of subjects.
The curriculum is broader, sure.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Well, it all worked out all right for you, I guess.
I can't complain. I'm 88, or almost 88. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much, sir, and thank you for serving our country. Let's bring Will back in just for a minute here. So, Will, did we miss on anything important that you covered in your stacks and stacks of paperwork and transcribing your interviews with Mr. Wolf?
No, I think it's fascinating that he went from radio to rockets and from typewriters to radio.
Did you guys use the rocket scientist joke at all in any of your discussions?
You know, should have. There's a lot of opportunity for bad jokes there. I feel like I'm missing out.
The Navy didn't think he had enough teeth, but he's got enough brains to be a rocket scientist, clearly. And I mentioned earlier that this is not the first interview you've done with this project at Fresno State. You've done a half dozen of them now. What are you going to do with this moving forward? Because this has been an educational experience for you. What do you feel like it's prepared you to do?
Well, I actually am hopefully going to pursue it in graduate school. I'd like to go on and get a more history-oriented degree, like public history or oral history, if I can find it. And I'd like to do this work, to mint new history, to write it down for people.
To go find people who haven't told their stories and get them recorded.
That's right.
I love it. Are you thinking about maybe being a history instructor, too? Or you think you're going to find a niche in just finding those histories and publishing them or something?
Well, I think I'm going to have a lot of rent to pay, so I'm probably going to end up teaching, yeah.
Well, is there anything else that you would say to maybe your fellow Bulldogs over there, students who saw this course for the Central California Veterans Oral History Project and are thinking about enrolling in that?
I would say do it, because there are always going to be more veterans than we have students to talk to, and there are a number of stories that simply won't be heard because we simply don't have people to go out there and ask them to listen to them. But it's not just a responsibility kind of thing. It's amazingly enriching to hear what people your age are capable of, and I think it challenges you to be better.
And I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I've gotten the sense from going to so many of these receptions and seeing each student get up with his or her veteran, and it seems like the young ladies really enjoy the older male veterans and vice versa, the way they interact. But I have yet to see a student who didn't look like he or she absolutely enjoyed it and really got a lot out of it. Do you get that sense, too, that it's a pretty universal satisfaction that students in this program end up with?
Oh, entirely. I think I've heard of maybe one bad experience. But by and large, the students go into it thinking you're just going to hear somebody ramble for a bit, and it's not that. It's somebody's life that they're trying to explain to you, and you learn a lot from that.
Amen. Amen. Well, Will, thanks for what you're doing, and good luck with all your endeavors in capturing some more history.
Thank you very much.
All right, that's Will Chapman. We also heard from Bob Wolf, a World War II veteran, and we're going to hear from another veteran and another student when Hometown Heroes continues next on KMJ. A high school where 98% of graduating seniors go to college, where success on the SAT and advanced placement or AP classes outpaces almost every other school in the valley. Home to a student newspaper that hauls in national awards on an annual basis. Its sports teams capture section championships. Have you figured it out yet? The school is Fresno Christian, and it's not just a high school. Fresno Christian offers a complete K-12 curriculum delivered by supremely qualified, experienced teachers who connect with their students personally, intellectually, and spiritually. Go to FresnoChristian.com to learn more about the value of a truly Christ-centered education. And if you want to see for yourself, call 299-1695 to schedule a campus visit. Whether it's kindergarten, high school, or anywhere in between, you'll get a genuine feel for what Fresno Christian's commitment to excellence could mean for your student. That number again, 559-299-1695. Fresno Christian Schools, education with a higher purpose. Hey, Bulldog fans, Paul Leffler here, coming to you not as the voice of the dogs, but as a husband and father of two. Ever have a hard time finding a restaurant that's family-friendly, won't set you back a week's pay, and has the kind of food that makes you want to keep coming back? I think I found it. And no, it's not one of those chains. It's one of a kind. Luna's Pizzeria, an Italian restaurant on Pulaski Avenue in Old Town Clovis. The Liberta family's been serving up great, authentic Italian food in the heart of cowboy country for more than 40 years. The pizza dough is made from scratch daily, and so is the bread. You won't forget the bread. I'm a sucker for that bread and the meatballs and the ravioli. And hey, did I say family friendly? How do you top a kid's menu with nothing over $3.95, drink included? I'm not making that up. See for yourself at lunasclovis.com. And while you're there, check out the family meal deals. That's lunasclovis.com or 299-4141. Tell them I sent you. And if you really want to, bring me back some bread. Luna's Pizzeria and Italian Restaurant. You'll love it at Luna's.
This is Hometown Heroes, honoring everyday Americans who answer the call of duty on 580 KMJ.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes. We'll come down the home stretch now as we continue to focus on a great program at Fresno State. It's so refreshing to see an educational institution branching out into new ways of educating our younger generations. One of those is preserving the stories of our older generations, like the greatest generation, the World War II veterans you hear from every week here, and a generation, along with other eras of veterans that students at Fresno State have been interacting with for the last few years through the Central California War Veterans Oral History Project. It's a really worthwhile program that I hope if you get a chance to either support or participate in, you will certainly consider that. You can contact Dr. Gary Rice at Fresno State for more information on that. We've heard from one student and one veteran. We're going to hear from another student now. Sammy Laproto joins us now. And Sammy, how old are you?
Afternoon, Paul. I'm 39.
Congratulations, Jack
about,
Benny.
About 21 years ago.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I just turned 60. And as a returning student, I have a lot of interesting anecdotes to tell you about that. But we'll save that for another day.
Well, yeah, and you know, typical college students in this program are not 60 years old, but I think it gave you a little perspective because your father was in World War II.
That was the whole deal. When I heard about this project, I dropped everything. And, you know, I really wasn't focusing on a particular era of a veteran. It just happened that way. I interviewed two other gentlemen that just happened to be World War II veterans. And when I came across Mr. Roberts' name, I couldn't wait to give him a call, and I thought I'd have to travel a long way to go talk to him.
From Fresno State?
Yeah, it turned out it was about a tenth of a mile from Fresno State. He's still living in the same house he bought there in 58, I believe.
Well, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because a lot of times some of the veterans I interview, they'll bristle at this name to the show, Hometown Heroes, because they don't consider themselves heroes. They'll say the heroes are the guys who didn't come home. But the reason I call it Hometown Heroes is because no matter where your hometown is, if it's Fresno, it's Clovis, it's Coarse Gold, it's Visalia, there are people around the corner from you that did crazy things way back when, and like you say, right across the street from Fresno State. Here's a guy with a few stories to tell.
Right there. I think when you bought that house, the campus had just opened. It was a brand new campus.
Yeah, it had moved from down on McKinley. And I want to ask you about Mr. Roberts, and we'll get to Mr. Roberts, who, folks, if you're a longtime listener to this show, maybe you heard him here on Hometown Heroes before. Maybe we'll get some different stories that we didn't have time to touch on last time. But, Sammy, before you tell me about him, I'm curious, in interviewing three different World War II veterans this last semester, did you feel like you were getting a little insight into what it must have been like for your father as well?
I think I got a little more than that, Paul. I got to tell you, at first, I thought it was a coincidence with my first veteran. The second veteran, The third veteran, wow. What a connection. They all crossed paths with my father somewhere along the line, whether it was on Guam or on the B-29s that Mr. Roberts worked on later on. Mm-hmm. There was this fascinating connection. It's almost eerie to the point of where, and I know, you know, what can you take from this? Well, I will continue to search for the real connection.
And I hope you update us when you discover it. And I know you're working on a book about your father. Did your father talk much about what he did in World War II?
Absolutely. His war stories over the years, and I think this is the most interesting part of these oral histories. Each student, now Will's generation, they're a generation removed from the stories. They're hearing it second, third hand. When you listen to your father's war stories, like John's son can tell you, you hear them over and over. And pretty soon, they're ingrained in your head. And one thing I can tell you about my dad's war stories, they never changed in embellishment. They were always the same. Mm-hmm. And I found that to be fascinating. So I drew quite a bit from this project.
All right, give us an introduction here for Mr. Roberts and what you really enjoyed about the time you spent listening to his stories.
Well, I'll tell you, Mr. John Roberts, U.S. Army Air Corps veteran, his stories were fascinating, but they were crystal clear. And a lot of them were so matter-of-factual, anecdotally amusing that we laughed the whole time we interviewed. You could ask him how he ended up getting drafted. We'll get to that in a minute. But fascinating part about Mr. Roberts was he was in an era where reinforcements were limited. He ended up staying on for 39 missions. Mm-hmm. So he flew an extra 14 missions in harm's way for his country and really never complained about it. In fact, he complained when they sent him home. So, and also just the way that he handled himself through his ordeals and his camaraderie and also his perseverance to the museum, to the bomb group, yeah, mm-hmm. and keeping touch with veterans until the end.
Well, I'm looking forward to the book you're putting together about your father, and let us know when you're done with that. Mr. Roberts wrote a book that I have a copy of from when he was on the show a few years ago, and what I couldn't call him then was 90-year-old John Roberts. So I want to welcome in the recent birthday boy, 90-year-old John Roberts of Fresno, California. Well, I'd ask you if you've found Murrieta's gold yet, but you probably couldn't answer me if you had an answer, so let's skip past that.
No, I don't have an answer.
Well, let's talk about the Army Air Corps. You got a nice introduction here.
Thank you.
From Sammy, the student who interviewed you for this project. 39 missions as a gunner on B-17s. What was the toughest thing you had to deal with?
You know, it was a job. Mm-hmm. And I really didn't think about the result or anything of that nature. We was just there to do a job, and we did it.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't really zero in on any one thing, really, basically.
What do the zeros have to do with it? You were fighting the Germans.
That's true.
And speaking of, 39 missions. How frequently did you, as a gunner, have fighter opposition that you were trying to take out?
It slacked off when we went to Russia. When we went to Russia, that was a special deal. We did not know why we were even there to begin with.
You're flying from Italy?
We flew from Italy.
Uh-huh.
We flew into Leningrad, Russia,
mm-hmm.
and waited around for a couple of days and then realized that, well, let me go back. Maybe I've told you this before, but we were given a gallon of white paint and a gallon of black paint.
Right.
And I did not know what to do with it, but I carried that thing around with me so that no one would steal it or take it. So when time, 3 o'clock in the morning, when Lieutenant Cool, my pilot, came to me and he says, I just opened a letter that I've been carrying around with me. He stating what we were to do with that paint. And he says, you choose one of your buddies, which I chose Richard Wood, the right waist gunner, to help me. And we went out and we painted the stripes, white and black stripes, on the aircraft that we had at that time.
It's a B-17.
It is a B-17, uh-huh. And it was to be an identification because I did not a one of us knew what why we were doing this, but we knew that something was up, and it was D-Day. Mm-hmm. And we finally made the trip into Romania, and we bombed a place in Romania. And I say that the flak and the fighters were very light because we come in from the north. And I imagine that they didn't even know we were there, the way we got in there. Mm-hmm. It was during a rainstorm that we landed, and so there was very little action. And, of course, when I got back to my base, after we bombed again going out on the second time on the 12th to get back to Foggia, Italy, it's Amadella Field is the name of it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, we got back to that base, and I asked one of the officers, I said, just what did we bomb? I said, I know it was looked to me like it was the airport. He said, well, yes, it was an airport, all right. I said, well, what did we bomb? He says, we bombed that base, and it was a German fighter repair and storage area for the Messerschmitt 109s, and we destroyed 143. We destroyed.
Mm-hmm. Probably did yourselves a favor for a lot of your future missions.
That's right.
I want to ask you what you got out of working with Sammy here and having your story preserved at Fresno State, because you talked to me before. You wrote your entire story down in a book called Homesick Angel. It's a great book. So what did you get out of this? You've already told your story. You've already written your story. Why take the time to tell somebody else about it and have it at Fresno
State?
Well,
I'm finding out that over the years that I have sold my book, it's been to the middle-aged people, mm-hmm. men and women both, and the young children. Mm-hmm. I just had a meeting up in River Park and explained that to them. I thought there would only be about 25 or 30 people there. There's 100 and how many did you say? 108 people were there.
Wow. Buying
and
a book.
And I sold 15 books while I was there, by the way. Uh-huh. I hate to say that. But anyway, and getting it out, it just amazes me that the age of the people that are buying my book, because they're not getting it in school, like I told you before. I think I told you anyway mm-hmm. before that the schools are not really going into detail. They said, well, World War I happened, World War II happened, and Korea happened, Vietnam happened. But they don't go into detail. And I don't know whether they're trying to protect the children or not, but they should really be given some kind of an answer to what really took place.
And as far as what really took place in your life, I remember from talking to you before that you felt very fortunate to make it home.
Extremely so.
That you felt someone was looking out for you.
Well, I can say that right now. The loss ratio when I got there was between 70 and 72%. It was really a chore. You asked me about how I felt about that. Well, the thing is, I just had to put that behind me. Now, I'm a Christian. Mm-hmm. I've been a Christian since I was 12 years old. And all of this time, all those years, the Lord has really helped me considerably to put that behind me. Mm-hmm. And people ask me this all the time. Well, how did you feel about, bombing? Well, I can't really answer that, other than the fact that we had, just like I was telling Sam, we had a job to do, and we did it. And I stayed on after the 25 because the loss ratio was so high, and our commanding officer asked us if we would stay, and we did. We all agreed to stay. Mm-hmm. We stayed. Then I got transferred to B-29s.
Well, and we're short on time on the program, but when you have 39 missions and you just described some of the emotions that came along with that, when you think back on the closest calls that you experienced, what's the one that jumps first to your mind that you think, boy, that could have gone a lot worse for me?
Maybe the trip from Russia to and finding out what we did was a very impressive setup, from what we did. most generally, we were, well, sometimes 20,000 feet up, and we dropped down to 13 to bomb and so forth, you know, in that area back and forth. It was just routine, really. Basically, it turned out just to be a routine setup for each mission. Each person did his job. Bombardier did his job. I was walking back and forth between the open bomb day to make sure the bombs were out. If they weren't out, then I'd have to call the pilot and the co-pilot and tell them to deviate over the ocean or wherever like that. And now I have to...
You'd have to manually disengage the bombs.
Yeah, the bomb.
Uh-huh.
And it just, that was just one of the main things. I hated to do it, but somebody had to do it, and I guess I was the only one there to do it.
So what you're talking about, for people at home to understand, make sure I understand it correctly, you're saying if a bomb gets jammed where it's not releasing, that you would go in the open bomb bay and tiptoe along the little slim separation between the two sides of that and hammer on a bomb until it falls off.
Actually, I had a screwdriver.
All right.
And this screwdriver, I could take and put it on there and twist it until the shackle would give way.
Uh-huh.
And it would drop the bombs. I don't know how many we did that to.
So one false move there, and you're sailing down. You are the bomb.
I am. That's very true. And the pilot kept that plane so straight and level while I was out there, you know, doing all this. And he did a beautiful job. He really did.
When you look back on it all, and like I said, you've talked about it, you've written a book about it, what are you most thankful for? What are you most proud of?
That I made it home.
Easy one to answer, huh?
Easy answer. With all that took place and everything that, you know, all around us and all this stuff, it's just that I was so fortunate to be able to get home. I came home on the USS Bliss, which was a Liberty ship, by the way.
And getting back home felt pretty good.
Well, it really felt good.
Is there anything else that you want us to know about your experience with Fresno State and this oral history project, what you got out of it?
You see, the thing is, I didn't know it even existed until Sam called me.
Right.
And we got together and we talked about it, and I gave him one of my books.
Cheat sheet, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, maybe some folks like you are hearing about it for the first time today and are going to want to get involved because of what you've had to share. Thank you again for serving our country and for keeping those stories alive.
Oh, you're welcome. So glad to do it. I'm glad to get it out.
Amen. Well, I know we could all sit here and talk about this for hours and hours, but it's only an hour-long show. I talked to Will about what he got out of it and what he's going to do with it moving forward. For you, having this experience at age 60, being back in school and interviewing these three different World War II veterans, how do you see this contributing to what you're going to do moving on from now?
Well, I have found that the degree of mass communications and journalism goes hand in hand with this sort of one-on-one interaction with veterans, with people like my dad. There's times when I'll be talking to John and I close my eyes and I think I'm talking to my dad. And like Will said, there's so many avenues to pursue. History, journalistic, I'm writing the book about my father, but yet there's so much more to do with the veterans. My job late last semester was to update lists of these surviving veterans. And when I had started the phone calls, I managed to contact seven widows. And that was a real tough for me to get through that because one of the veterans lived maybe three or four doors down from me up in Oakhurst. And he had just passed at the start of the semester. Couldn't get to all of them in time. So like you said, if there's a veteran out there that's hearing this, please contact Dr. Gary Rice at Fresno State so we can hear your story. Save it for your grandchildren and their children.
Amen. And we have all that information on our website at kmjnow.com. Thanks to Sammy Laproto, to Will Chapman, and to our veterans today, John Roberts and Bob Wolf. And if you missed any part of this program, you can catch it online at kmjnow.com. We'll be back with another edition of Hometown Heroes next week here on KMJ.